Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, Adam, we are going to get to talk with Dr. Antonia Esselin about high technology in low resource communities.
Yeah, she had a really marvelous editorial commentary in the New England Journal of Medicine talking about her work in Haiti. And I think this will be a fascinating discussion and an insight on an area of the world that was decimated that we don't perhaps think of as often as we should.
I'm looking forward to that conversation. First, Adam, we have some research that matters about prostate cancer, about curry compounds.
Two articles about prostate cancer that I think will be important to most of our listeners and their families.
And also about diet tied to breast cancer risk.
Well, we'll talk a lot about cancer and maybe some ways of preventing it. Let's dive right in, Christy. Our very first article that was actually in the New England Journal of Medicine about outcomes of surgery, and does surgery for prostate cancer for many people actually lead to improvements in survival?
Well, it's interesting. We've talked about prostate cancer and screening before, Adam, and it's tricky because most people will say that more men die with prostate cancer than from prostate cancer. But yet, if you're told you have PPR, then many people want to go ahead and get that cut out.
Well, and in this, and we do know that prostate cancer, you know, there's 240,000 new cases a year and 28,000 deaths. It is one of the major causes of death among men.
And it's so tricky to figure out which men really will benefit from surgery as extending or improving life and which ones it really might cause more harm for, because it does leave people often with problems with impotence and problems with urination.
Right. And this particular study was based on 731 men who had been diagnosed with prostate cancer, usually as a result of the PSA test. And they were either given to randomly have their prostate removal or just observed, and then they followed these men out to see what types of outcomes happened.
And basically what they found was not a significant difference between the people who had the surgery to have the tumor removed compared with those who were observed over time.
In terms of overall mortality, because 47% of the men in the surgery group died compared to 50% of the others. There was a slight reduction in those who died of the prostate cancer in the surgery group, but not a benefit in terms of overall mortality, and there were really significant side effects.
Yeah, I mean, a significant portion of them have had problems with impotence and with incontinence, where you have trouble holding your urine.
Right, 81% of those who had surgery had impotence compared to 44% in the observation group, and in terms of loss of control of the bladder, 2 to 3 times more who had surgery had that problem compared to those who were observed.
So surgery is not the clear, obvious answer.
Certainly for those early ones with the PSA, maybe that's low, they still think that there may well be those who have high PSA, certainly could still benefit. So I don't think it's the end answer, but it certainly is a good starting point. Speaking of which, Christy, our very next research article, I think, extends this starting point to the conversation we need to now have.
It does. This is a study in the Journal of Clinical Oncology and looking at the difference in what people choose about surgery or observation when given their counseling just by whichever doctor they're talking with, compared with having a team approach.
Right. Traditionally, maybe 9 out of 10 men who have prostate cancer would opt for treatment, including surgery or radiation. And what they wanted to find out is, well, what happens if you have these men actually meet with a team versus not meet with the team? And does that matter which therapy they get?
So they looked at about 700 men with low-risk prostate cancer that were seen at hospitals in Boston, and about a third of them worked with the multidisciplinary team of doctors. So not just a urologist surgeon or just a radiologist who may have their particular bias on the situation based on what they know,
or what they believe.
To have a team approach. So about a third of them had that team approach and they followed to see the results.
Right. And among those who worked with that team of doctors, 43% opted to just kind of watch and wait compared to immediate surgery or radiation, compared to only 22% who did not have that team approach, opted to watch and wait. So almost twice, a much larger percentage went for surgery or radiation if they only met with a surgeon or only met maybe with a radiation oncologist, which suggests maybe that's not necessarily the wrong approach, but it suggests we really should be emphasizing, I believe, a team approach to the care of prostate cancer.
That's true. A team approach for the care of most patients.
And, good point.
And we, you know, it'll be interesting to, as we follow these people out over time to see how the outcomes vary.
Well, let's talk about one more cancer article that we actually had. And this was a research on breast cancer that was in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition.
So they looked at 335,000 European women.
That's a lot.
and tied together information about their diets, and in particular their glycemic load. So the high glycemic load, or it means you are eating a lot of foods that cause that rapid spike in blood sugar. So juices and simple carbohydrates tend to do that. And they tried to link that with certain breast cancers.
Right. And so of the nearly 335,000 women in the study, a little over 11,000 did develop breast cancer over 12 years. And overall, there was no link between that glycemic load and women who had a certain type of breast cancer that was hormone negative when they tested the cells. That particular group, there was a significantly increased risk. So what do you think? I don't know. This gets kind of complicated here.
Yeah, to me, it seems like we're fishing for answers, which we should be because we want to understand cancer and try to prevent it. Right. But to me, there's not too much of a take-home message to change your diet in a specific way for preventing breast cancer. But I do think that we know that high glycemic diets have all kinds of associations with diabetes and weight problems and other things.
So it's a good thing to do regardless.
If it
lowers certain women's risk of developing breast cancer, that's an added bonus. There's no downside, is there?
No, there really isn't.
So? No.
Okay, our last one is also about diet, and this is about curry compounds.
Curry. Do you use curry, Christy? That's not easy to say. You use curry, Christy.
When I'm eating Thai or Indian food, sure.
You don't just kind of add it routinely as a way of lowering your risk of diabetes, do you?
No, I don't. But
there's some research on this particular question.
There is. So this was published in the journal Diabetes Care, and they followed people, it was a Thai study, over 9 months to see if a daily dose of curcumin,
which is the active ingredient in cumin.
Exactly. If taking a daily dose of these capsules compared with placebo had differences in people developing diabetes.
Right. And we do know that there's some evidence that curry has some antioxidant and some effects potentially on the immune system. And they found that 19 of the 115 or so people who did not take this curry compound developed diabetes. And they said that none of the 15-20 patients who took the cumin compound developed diabetes. If true, that's a pretty startling result there, that it would have had a potentially protective effect. I was impressed, though I also was a little worried.
Well, I would want to see this replicated in another population with a bigger sample size or more people involved in the study. But it was
1.5 grams of curry a day. I don't think that's a small amount.
No.
You know, they didn't talk about too much about side effects and long-term use. And so, you know, but it's interesting.
It is interesting, and it's promising. We want to decrease diabetes risk. So this is promising. I think if you already, for me, if I am already eating curry, I'll think happy thoughts as I'm doing it, but I'm not going to go out and start supplementing that much.
As your mouth is on fire, you'll say there's a light at the end of the tunnel. Well, yeah. That'll conclude our Research That Matters, Christy. We've had a nice chance to talk about actually some interesting research on curry and interesting research on diet and lowering breast cancer risk, possibly by eating low glycemic index foods.
And also about prostate cancer surgery maybe being just as good for low-risk cancers as observation, and the team approach being different than seeing a single doctor. And we both favor having a team approach to cancer care.
Speaking of team approach, when we return, we're going to be talking with Dr. Antonia SLN about high technology in low resource communities, a fascinating article from the New England Journal of Medicine. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email uc@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. Antonia SLN about high technology and low resource communities, stimulated by a wonderful and passionate and humane essay that Dr. SLN wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine recently. Dr. SLN is the medical director of the University of Miami-affiliated hospital Bernard Meves Project MediShare in Haiti. Welcome to our show, Dr. SLN.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you for asking me on.
We are glad to have you. You know, we'd love to hear a bit about, before we hear about your story that you wrote about your story of what led you to work in Haiti and become a part of this group, Project MediShare.
My story is basically I'm a Haitian American, first generation Haitian American, and I've always wanted to work as a physician in Haiti since I was probably in high school, the end of high school, beginning of college. I grew up in a very proud family, and most of my family were immigrants from fleeing the Duvalier era, and always intended on going back to Haiti, but never was able to go because of the political turmoil. So it's something that I've always wanted to do. I never really understood why people who immigrate to this country don't go back home when they've been able to do better, to kind of make things better. And that's just something I've always wanted to do. I was very struck when I was little, and my mom took me to visit my grandparents at the poverty. Just really struck me. It always bothered me. And the people were always so sick, and I just always wanted to train myself to be able to intervene, if you will. So it's been a lifelong passion for me. And I'm just, very fortunate to be able to do what it is that I set out to do.
So it sounds like you decided as a teenager in high school that you were going to set out and go to medical school and actually return to Haiti and make a difference.
Yes, that's basically
commendable.
What has driven me to do this, yes.
Well, and I must say, this particular article certainly hit me personally because I was down working with Project MediShare a little, almost 2 years ago, a year after the earthquake hit, and it's, you know, we Haiti was on all of our minds, the world's minds, and I guess perhaps it's maybe with everything in time it falls off a little bit, and I think your article stimulates us again to think about Haiti. Tell us how you, because you're also on faculty at Miami, so you split your time or you go down there regularly, or how does that work?
So what I do is I'm on service 3 months out of the year at the University of Miami, and the rest of the time I'm in Haiti. So it's split over the course of the year.
So you spend a lot of time in Haiti, and how long have you been doing that?
It's been, I'm going on year 3 right now.
Wow, so you've been there really throughout the whole devastation and the aftermath.
Yes. I did it before. I was working with another organization called HOPE, which was in the north part of Haiti. I had been doing that since medical school, and so I'd been working in the healthcare arena in Haiti since 1997 or so, and 1998 or so, and was actually on my way to go back to that community in the north of Haiti in this town called Bourne when the earthquake hit. I was on my way to Haiti when the earthquake hit.
Wow.
And so I was on an elective during my residency, and I basically, instead of going to the north, Project MediShare was the only organization that was able to get me down to Haiti within 36 hours, I believe I was there. And it was using the Haitian American Physicians Abroad organization. That's how they were able to blast us and find Haitian physicians that wanted to, that they were trying to recruit to come down. And that's how I was able to get in contact with MediShare. So I had been there for, I stayed for 3 weeks right after the earthquake. And then after I was done, I spent a year as doing this chief medical officer position right after my residency.
Well, considering the timing and the amount of time that you're spending down there, I'm sure you have experience and story after story of devastation, but also of healing and of hope. And I wonder what it was about this particular story that you wrote about. We want to hear the story for sure for our listeners. But what was it that really struck you about this particular scenario?
Well, you know, doing this job, and especially with the system that we have, as Adam was saying, he came down and volunteered with us. It's a system of volunteers. So every week we have a new set of volunteers that come through and help us out with the medical care and the intake of the patients that we receive at the hospital. And every week it's a new group, it's new different people. But the same question always came up in the ICU, which was how far are we going? You know, what is the end point? And it just always came this question so quickly here. Like, why are they, like, when I was doing my residency and when I work in the States, this question never, like, but not that it's never brought up, but it's never so early. It's never brought up so early. So why every single person who comes through, it's always really quickly, people are ready to give up. I'm not really understanding.
Why is that?
Pardon me?
Why do you think that happened so early there?
I don't know. I just was reflecting on that a lot. I was just thinking about it a lot. And I would always get into these conversations with people, which was basically what I think I said in the article, which was, you know, you do what you can with what you have. If it's completely 100% medically futile, of course we're going to stop. But this person deserves a chance, you know, if we can give them a chance. Now, if we can't give them a chance, then of course, you know, we can start the conversation. But we should try. And so I kept getting into these conversations with different people, trying to understand why are you so quick to give up, or, you know, why is this so already futile for you? You know, when there's probably an opportunity. I mean, I've seen a lot of things. I've seen a lot of miracles. I've seen a lot of tragedies as well. And so I kind of, and the way that I work anyway is that I just look at every case for what it presents. And you have to kind of look at every case and decide what you're going to do with that case. And it just seemed to me that it was just always coming up pretty early. And so what happened with this case in particular, the reason why I felt compelled to write about it, was that it was with her, and I don't know if it was brought out in the article, but the challenge with her was that she was already, we didn't know what was wrong with her. We intubated her, stabilized her.
Tell our listeners just the first couple lines about what we're talking about here.
The 12-year-old girl,
yes.
That
uh-huh.
came to our hospital basically unresponsive by her family. And initially, the first doctor who had seen her, they were thinking that maybe she was in DKA. You know, her sugar was high, apparently, when they had first done the primary assessment. But she wasn't breathing. She was breathing very strangely, and she was not responsive. And the story from her mom was that she had woken up basically she had tried to wake her up for the morning, the day before, and she hadn't woken up. And they were just trying to get her down to Port-au-Prince. They're from the countryside, and so it took them some time to kind of get down to Port-au-Prince for them to get some help.
36 hours.
Yeah, it took 36 hours. It took 36 hours for them to find a car and, you know, make sure it was they could get her in it. I mean, it's a big challenge getting transportation in this country.
And in this situation, you had a child who you, of course, want to do everything for, as you would anyone, but a young person, and who was severely, severely ill, but you didn't know why.
Yeah, we had no idea. I was working along with one of the volunteers, who was one of my friends at the time, who was there in the ER. He intubated her. We stabilized her on the vent, and hydrated her, trying to figure out what's wrong with her, what's going on. After we hydrated her, gave her antibiotics, not sure exactly what was going on, trying to figure out what could be the problem, she wakes up and she starts to, respond, So she's telling us, are you hurting? No, I'm not in any pain. She's able to move only one side of her body, but it wasn't really clear. She was pretty weak, so we weren't really sure. Was she hemiplegic? Was she not hemiplegic? What's going on? So then we decided, okay, let's scan her head. We have the CT scanner that was donated by Wyclef Jean, the Yele Foundation. So we were able to do a CT scan, and we do the CT scan, and she has this horrifying mass that is just, it's horrifying.
A brain tumor.
Right, this brain tumor. We sent it to the people, I think we sent it to someone in Miami who told us that it was a glioma. And a stage 4 glioma. And here's the dilemma for me at that moment was this child is responding. She's not unconscious. She's talking, but she can't breathe because we tried to wean her off the vent and off the ventilator, and we couldn't do it.
Well, Dr. Esslin, we're going to need to take a short break. And
sure.
There's never a good time for a break. And there's
no problem.
But this story is so compelling. But when we come back, we're going to pick up on, what did you do? What can you do? And what really happened? So we're talking with Dr. Antonia Esslin about high technology and low resource communities. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
By UNC, supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Antonia Esslin, a Haitian-American physician working back and forth between Miami and Haiti, about her story and the story of this young child who you discovered had a big, terrible brain tumor through the technology and resources that you had at the time. And, one of the things that strikes me is you've got the CT scanner now, and you could scan her head, maybe to find something you could do something about.
Right.
But you find something that you can't.
Right.
And so how do you wrestle with that and to have the technology to say what it is, but no means to do anything about it?
Right. Well, I mean, the one thing is that at least and one of the things in resource poor settings is a lot of the time people die and there's no answer. And so one of the family was the reason why this was happening. It's not a magical spell, for example, or
something they did wrong
or whatever. It's something medical. This was unfortunately her destiny to have this tumor, and this is what's going to happen to her, and this is why she's dying. It's an explanation, and at that time when you're faced with a terminal illness, usually a lot of the time up until this point, anybody who I had that was intubated, dependent on the vent, was someone who was unconscious, not really responding at all, and then the decision is to withdraw care and and that kind of thing. But she was awake. And at this point, the question is, what do you do now?
Well, and go ahead.
Yeah, no, the question is, what do you do now? And it's really hard. It's basically really hard. It's basically now we have to hospice this child who's awake. And so what am I going to do? Because she has a stage 4 tumor. She can't breathe. She's completely dependent on the vent. I'm not going to put a tracheostomy on her. That's not going to be a good use. That's going to be torture. To what end would I do that? So
right, and
I spoke to the family.
Now, I wanted to ask you before you kind of go on, because I think what I also hear is you've got this technology that allowed you to make a diagnosis relatively quickly and get pathology back relatively, really quickly. That's as good as many places in the world, if not better. And yet you don't have the drugs there to necessarily give her palliative care, necessarily have the morphine, the more common low-tech drugs, that had to have been frustrating at some levels, even before you now go into the family, because, you know, you're trying to think, what can you really do?
Right. Well, we had to scrounge. I think at that time we had some donated meds, and one of the things we were able to get in relatively good supply is diazepam.
Mm-hmm. So Valium, yes.
Yeah, Valium. So we were able to use that to kind of sedate her and to keep her calm. And we were able to get our hands on some morphine at that time. So we were able to aliquot or ration it out, if you will, so that we could give her, you know, she was little, she didn't need that much to kind of keep her pain free. So that actually was very helpful.
So then what other things how did you decide about how you were going to talk about this with the family?
Well, I just decided to talk to them. I just sat them down and then told them, explained to them what I saw in the snow scan and what the prognosis was, and that there was no way to get her off the ventilator to have her breathe, and that, you know, if you can't breathe, you unfortunately pass away. And, you know, the response was that they wanted to take her home, which is not very uncommon in Haiti. Many of the times, if a family member is going to die, there's nothing more that the hospital can do than the family wants to usually have them die at home. That's a very common thing.
But here you've got this family who lives really, really far away.
Right.
And a child who can't live without the breathing machine.
Exactly. So how am I going to do it, right? Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I talked to one of the local Haitian doctors, Rivette Monoli, who's amazing. And we were both, like, looking at each other, like, what are we going to do? How are we going to get her home? She's going to die once we take the tube out. There's no way that she's going to be able to make it. And we didn't want her to die on the way. And Dr. Monoli was like, you know what? I think you're going to have to bag her. You're going to have to bag her. And I said, you know, that's a great idea.
So let's
bag her.
Let's explain what that means to our listeners.
Oh, yeah. So we're going to take an ambu bag. I don't know how to explain an ambu bag.
A boxing glove with air in the middle.
Sure. And you know, once you disconnect them from the ventilator that's what's providing the pressure for you to breathe, you can actually do it with your hand by pushing on this bag.
Which is very tiring for an individual to do after about 2 minutes, and you're going to try to do this for a couple hours.
Right, right. But I thought the idea was brilliant, you know, because we were like, that's great. We can get her home, and then she'll die in their arms. She won't have to die in the hospital, and that's what they wanted. And so we decided, you know, we packed up the car, we got the oxygen, we got the meds, you know, in little syringes, enough for the trip just to keep her comfortable. And we had started the process of sedating her so she would be calm already. And we took her all the way to her home, which was about 2 hours away. When we finally got there, you know, she was very calm. She had already started to drift, I believe. She had already started to drift at that point. We got her and I was getting ready. They had the cot ready for her, and we were getting ready to go to her home. And they were like, "Nah, you can't, doctor. There's no way." And I was like, come on, you can do it. I hiked before. I'm ready. I've hiked before. I'm Haitian. Like, I'm not afraid of these mountains. Are you kidding me? And they were like, you can't. There's no way you're going to be able to do it. And I guess, you know, the logistics of having to press on this bag while you're hiking with this child is impossible, is basically what they were saying. And so I had to decide to disconnect her there from the tube, from the tube that was keeping her alive at that point. Hmm. And that was really hard. That was really, really hard. But
yeah, you talk about it as one of the hardest things you ever had to do, and yet it also sounds like one of the most compassionate things too.
Yeah, it was a hard moment. It was a difficult moment.
Compassionate, though, because you allowed the family to, at least their intent was to take her home, and you allowed that to happen and facilitated that, which I imagine has to mean a lot to them. And I don't know if that's really one of your take-home messages about how you balance high technology and low resource settings. You don't give up compassion in any form or fashion.
Well, I really agree, Adam, that the striking point is the way you stuck with this family and advocated for them and went, I mean, that's above and beyond. So many people would have said, well, it's impossible or it's futile. She's going to die on the way, and just sort of not gone any further. But yet you saw the value of this family and stuck with them. How did that, or how does that sit and resolve and sort of shape who you are as a physician moving forward?
Oh, I don't know. That's a tough question. I don't know. I didn't really think about it that way, actually. I just want them to know that we're there for them and that we're not just here, you know, in Haiti to, you know, I don't know, to say that we're there and not do anything and to just decide that because this is a patient that's going to die that we don't care. I really didn't want them to feel that way. I wanted them to know that I was hurting too, and that I wanted to help midwife them, as Timothy Quill says, and I referenced that in the article. He has a really good book on this whole dying process thing, but I really wanted to be with them. This is hard to lose a 12-year-old. This is not an 80-year-old person with a stroke. This is a 12-year-old girl who was fine a week before. So, you know, I wanted to really just hold their hand. I know it sounds a little corny, but I really wanted to just hold their hand and help them through and let them know that they weren't by themselves, that they weren't alone, and that you know, and that I was grieving with them. And
I think you also did it for the child.
Yeah.
And you held that child's hand, literally her life, and helped her. And I think for me, a take-home message, perhaps unintended, is what we all as providers around the world need to remember, is that regardless of the technology we have or don't have, when in death decisions, being there with them is, and the way that you were there for your patient and her family, is something that we can never give up. And we are so admiring your spirit of doing this for her and her family.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for taking time with us to share your story. And we hope that our listeners would look in the New England Journal of Medicine for your article, just a remarkable story of compassion.
We've been talking with Dr. Antonia SLN about her experiences of high technology care and low resource settings in Haiti. We'll put information about Project MediShare and your work up on our website. And we want to thank you again for being our guest.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes to talk about your health questions and concerns.
We have some wonderful questions today, Christy, about a problem with the tongue and a painful area on the tongue.
About a tetanus booster or Tdap.
About rashes, and does it matter what the diagnosis is? And the answer is probably.
And about what to do with an umbilical cord in a newborn baby.
So we got a couple baby questions and a couple adult questions.
We do. All right.
Let's
family
dive
medicine.
Right in and listen to our very first listener house call.
I have been having a weird feeling on my tongue that has been going on for 6 weeks or so. There's a little red spot at the tip. It feels like it is burned, but I didn't burn it or do anything to bring this on. I asked my dentist, and he thought it could be an allergy to a new food. Do you have any other ideas? Otherwise, I feel fine.
Well, if it's a new lesion on your tongue versus an old lesion that you're getting recurrent, I guess that would be something I would think would be a differentiation to me between something that's, you know, a little more worrisome and versus something that's less worrisome.
This could be a bunch of different things, most of which fall in the category of probably not going to kill you.
And we may not be able to figure it out.
That's right. But you can have these little benign ulcers like you can get anywhere else in your mouth called aphthous ulcers, which hurt.
And we call them benign, but, you know, even spelling them is difficult. A-P-H-T-H-O-U-S, I think something like that. But we'll put our health sciences librarians put a link up here. But these are what are thought to be viral or possibly, we don't really know fully, but things that you can get more chronically.
There are also some nutritional things that could affect and give you strange feelings on your tongue, B12, zinc, some other things that maybe kind of reach in deep, but could cause something like that.
And then you have these little things on their tongues. We all have them. They're called papillae, and they're just those normal little bumps you see on the tongue. And sometimes they can get clogged, or you can get some debris in them, or they can get irritated. Sometimes you bite your tongue. That'll get better. That's why if you haven't had it before, hopefully it'll go away, and hope we never have that again. It can't be fun to have lesions on your tongue. I've had them. They're not fun.
All right, let's take our next house call question about tetanus.
I had a tetanus booster, the TBAP, 5 years ago when I had my last baby. One doctor told me I need a repeat now, and another told me it can last for 10 years, which is correct.
So this is confusing, and I see why you're getting different advice from physicians. So the tetanus booster you're supposed to have every 10 years, but when the Tdap, which is the tetanus booster that also has pertussis protection, that came out about 5 years ago or 2006, somewhere in there, when that came out, what they said was if you haven't had a booster in the last 5 years, go ahead and get this Tdap. It's a one-time protection, and then after that, you don't need a tetanus booster for 10 years after that.
Right. So it could be both the doctors are actually correct, depending on what their understanding your history is. But and we have seen this dramatic increase in cases of pertussis all around the country. So getting that Tdap booster, but it sounds like she had that just recently.
Right. And so if you've had the Tdap, then your next TD booster is 10 years
right.
from that point, at least according to the current CDC guidelines. And we know that sometimes those change.
Yeah, and I had someone who came in, Christy, the other day and that said they needed a tetanus booster. And I said, when was the last one? And they said, oh, it's been 10, 12, 14 years ago. And it was ready to go. And I said, let me just look at your record. And I found out she had actually had a tetanus booster 6 years ago. And she was like, I don't remember that. And so, but we have now with our electronic medical records, I found it actually in three different places on the health record, all in the chart. And I said, you know what? There are very few things that we document three times. The fact that we have three times documented, it's probably pretty good. So nowadays, hopefully, you don't have to always remember when you had your last one. Our records can keep track of it for us.
That makes me happy. I was on that immunization committee that put that in the chart so many times.
Yay.
Yay.
Christy, let's okay. talk about our very next house call about someone who has a rash and wonders, does it matter about the diagnosis?
I have a rash on my elbow and arms. The doctor told me it could be eczema or psoriasis and gave me a steroid cream. Does it matter which of these problems is the true diagnosis?
You know, this is a pretty common scenario where the doctor may not know exactly what it is at first, but to give a steroid cream, which is likely to improve either scenario, is pretty standard that without having a biopsy or a real solid diagnosis to say this is for sure one versus the other.
And, you know, I think it probably does matter what the diagnosis is because the treatments aren't all the same. And psoriasis can be more resistant and typically has more medicines that we typically use for it sometimes that are sometimes more aggressive and light therapies that we do that we don't always do for eczema. So I think, you know, hopefully the doctor can tell the difference maybe by where it's located and how it looks. And if necessary, maybe do a biopsy. But I do think it might be important. Just throwing steroids at it, saying it's going to get better, doesn't help you think about, God, how am I going to deal with this the rest of my life?
Well, and you can have other parts. You can have other parts of your body that become affected. Some people get something called psoriatic arthritis or other problems.
Good point.
So you might want to know, too, because of thinking about, you know, other potential effects on your body.
That's right. Well, hopefully that's helpful. And let us know. And let's listen to our very last house call question.
I just had a baby, and I'm confused what to do with the umbilical cord. Some people tell me to use alcohol, but the doctor said I didn't need to do that. Now it's bleeding a little with a drop of blood on the diaper. Should I be worried?
Happy birthday. Congratulations on the new baby.
Mm-hmm. Baby. Well, and when I first read this, Christy, I thought, do they want to use alcohol? Well, I don't know. Maybe it's a celebration. But then I realized it's alcohol on the umbilical cord.
yes, which is something that, for whatever reason, we are always told to put alcohol around the base of that umbilical cord, but you really don't need to. If you just leave it alone, it'll fall off in a couple weeks.
It doesn't probably hurt, but there's no need to do it either.
Right, sure. And, you know, if you had a lot of bleeding, then that would be of concern that you'd want to bring the baby in. But a little drop or smear on the diaper is pretty common as it's sort of slowly separating. And generally,
what would be the things that you would worry about with the umbilical cord in terms of needing to come see the doctor? What would you recommend?
I think if it was bleeding, like significantly, not a drop or two, but just ongoing oozing or bleeding.
Mm-hmm. If it looked like it was infected, even though it's rare.
That is very rare. But if it was infected or had pus coming out of it, you would want to.
Yes.
And I can't, those are the only two I can really think of.
Occasionally I've seen where you can get a granuloma, or you can have a scar tissue that's beyond scar tissue. And sometimes that has to be cauterized or burned or removed. But I haven't seen that in a while.
And some people will have an umbilical hernia where there's sort of a bulge right there at the belly button. And that's something you can ask your doctor about. And usually we'll just watch that and it gets better on its own. But it's worth talking about.
Everything you want to know about your umbilical cord, but we're afraid to ask. Well, Christy, that'll conclude our house calls. But I'm glad we've had a chance to talk not just about the umbilical cord problems, but also about maybe a rash that could well be psoriasis.
And boosters. And also about a strange feeling on a listener's tongue that we sure hope goes away soon.
Those papillae, we hope that they get healing. Well, thank you for joining us today for your health. We hope we've answered questions that are important to you and your health, and you can send us your own question at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at Your Health Radio and go to our new health app by searching on Your Health and send us a question.
We want to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Antonia Esselin.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. And we'll talk with you again next week. Can't wait. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heels station.